Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the second instalment of Megillus Esther. Last week, we gave an introduction as to set the scene as to what was going on in Megillus Esther at around that time and for about the 100 years prior regarding Israel's spiritual descent that led... Just a minute, I'm going to mute everyone. That led to Israel being exiled into Persia Media in the first place. Okay? And then we talked about how the Jews were at a very low ebb spiritually while they were in Persia Media. And we read through, I think, the first, I don't know, four or five psukim. I think we did the first four psukim actually. Together, and now want to do some continuing background over those four psukim so we can get from those four psukim into the next pasuk. But those four psukim are big because they give a lot of interest. There's quite a lot that I'd like to say. If I can remember, there's also a groh I want to give you and a radal, and there's lots of different midrashim that I want to scatter in. But essentially, I want to set the scene. I'm carrying on from those first four psukim. And there's an amazing in Esther Rabbah 1:1. Now, that's not the beginning of Esther Rabbah. Esther Rabbah is huge because there's a massive psichta, as I said to you last time. There's an opening which discusses all the medrash about how the rabbis would even open a discussion talking about Megillus Esther, which is half of the Sefer. So you have to go through half the Medrash Rabbah to get to verse 1 of chapter 1. Do you understand how much background detail there is? So I've clearly not gone through all that background detail with you, which would take months before we hit the first Pasuk. But you do see from that that there is such a vast amount of data that is associated with it. And we're going to kind of crunch through that today and get through the first four Pasukim. I'd like to get... My eyes are on, you know, Psukim 6, 7, 8. That's what I'm looking at for today. So with your Rishus, I'm going to dive straight in. Is that okay? Unless there's any questions that you have had based upon what we have discussed last week that you would like clarification over. Okay. Esther Rabbah 1:1, which is halfway through the Sefer. Okay, you have to go through tons of material to get to chapter 1, verse 1 in Esther Rabbah to find it. And it says unbelievably, mystically, cryptically on these words. It was in the days of Achashverosh. We started off, the first pasuk was Vayhibim Achashverosh. Hu Achashverosh HaMelech Mahadu Va'ad Kush. It's the same Achashverosh that ran all the world kind of thing. Says the first thing on the Medrash. It was in the days of Achashverosh, the man that killed his wife because of his beloved friend, Memuchan, who said, "Ach, kill her. She's worthless. Kill her. She's defied you." He said, "Fine. Forget the fact she's Nebuchadnezzar's daughter. Forget the fact, you know, that all my advisors are telling me no. I love Memuchan so much, I'll listen to him and kill my own wife." Who, by the way, was Memuchan? Do we know who Memuchan actually was? Memuchan was Haman. Boo! It was Haman. Very good. Thank you very much. Every time I say Haman, I'd like a nice... Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. It's warming up for the real deal on Purim. So it was in the days of Achashverosh that he, Achashverosh, slaughtered his beloved wife because of his beloved friend. This is the same Achashverosh, the same man who later killed his beloved friend because of his wife. He killed Haman because of Esther. Haman. He killed Haman because of Esther. It's going to be a long night. Okay, don't worry about it. So he killed Haman because Esther said, he sold my people. And he said, who? And he goes, he did. So he killed him. Hold on, he just killed his previous wife. He killed his previous wife because of what he told him to do. And now he's willing to kill him because... This is very puzzling. Can we put together a psychological profile of Ahasuerus? I think it's fair to say he had a very erratic, unstable nature with a temper that was very quick to flare and very quick to calm down. He got angry furiously like that to the point of killing Vashti, which we know later he regretted because his friend told him. And he got angry later like that to the point of killing Haman until immediately it says he calmed down once he hanged Haman and then he lived with Esther. See, he's the kind of man which will willingly kill his own wife or his best friend depending upon the mood he's in. As we'll see later, this is of a tremendous benefit for Klal Yisrael. Tremendously good news that we're dealing with an individual who is so easily swayed. That's why the Megillah says, right in the beginning, B'yimei Ahasuerus, who Ahasuerus HaMelech? It's the same man that killed his wife that killed Haman. Now, the reason he killed his wife was because a Nazi, Haman, told him to do it. So that would make the king a Nazi sympathizer, right? But he's also the same man that killed the head of the Nazi party because his wife told him to, which would make him a resistance hero, right? It's the same guy. That's why it says it's Ahasuerus, the very same Ahasuerus, to tell you deeply about his incredibly fickle nature. The man that was our greatest enemy in the end became benevolent to the Jews. That is not that paints a picture of a psychological profile which tells you a lot about one of the main protagonists in the story. So the Megillah begins by saying that the whole thing is clearly miraculous. For there was woe, oy vey, vayehi b'mei, is always a bad sign, right? Whenever you go, oy vey, it was in the beginning of the days, it's always bad news, says the Medrash. And why was it bad news? Vayehi b'mei Ahasuerus. Because we were in the days of a Nazi. We were in the days of a Ahasuerus, who was as wicked, cruel a tsar as we've ever seen. This ruler killed his wife because of his beloved friend. And the king's wrath against her did not subside until he had carried out his plan. But this is the same Ahasuerus who reversed his tendency to beloved Haman and killed his friend because of Esther. Why would Hashem organize it as such? Let me tell you a problem. And I've heard it with my own ears back in the Clinton administration and all the nonsense that you hear now regarding Donald Trump is that Jews are only too happy to rely on a leader who seems philo-Semitic or pro-Israel. When they feel as if they've got a helper in the Senate or the White House or the palace, they think, we'll just leave it to them and we'll be fine. This is a problem the Jews have. To offset this problem of having Esther in Parliament, which is something all the Jews would rely on and say, don't worry about it at all. Esther will convince him to save us. We need a man who, like this, will murder his most beloved queen. To keep you, the Jewish population, on your toes on tefillah and avodah. Don't you rest assured that you'll have political help in Parliament with the kind ministers who will save you. Don't you think that's where you're coming from? This is the kind of guy that will kill his wife on a dime. So she is as in a difficult situation as you are. Dovin to me. I've got a whole sheer about how Donald Trump is one of the worst enemies of the modern state of Israel that you could possibly imagine since the state of Israel was incepted. And everyone thinks he was pro-Israel. He couldn't have done Israel a worse deal than he's done. But people trust in him because he's pro-Israel. As we see, Jews are very trusting of Goyisha leaders in their hope that they will save the Jews from difficulty. In Esther, already God is sowing seeds to say, don't you think that's the way it's going to work? Yes, you have a Jewish woman right at the top, as it were. Yes, you have a Jewish woman right at the top that might save you in your thoughts. But I tell you now, she's not going to be your savior. Only I am. Yet in the end, God used her as a vehicle of salvation. Once you accepted that God was pulling the strings, then he hides behind human intervention. How interesting. Remember, the Megillah was written in the day of Ahasuerus and he read it. So we can't write outright the wicked King Ahasuerus, the absolute Nazi who wanted to kill us, because that would lead to problems of him reading it and then getting annoyed. So it had to be read in such a way that it was parav about Ahasuerus. Yet these clues, it was Ahasuerus, the same Ahasuerus, nudge, nudge, which wink, 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 which tell the enlightened Jewish reader that things were not simple about Ahasuerus. He was no friend of the Jews. But it had to be written like that, that it could be construed that he was, because it was like a newspaper that was published during the day, so much so, the minhag is we must read it like an igeret, like a letter. It's got to be folded flat on the bimah and read like a newspaper. Because it was like a newspaper in its day. So we had to be very careful how it was written with double entendres that only the learned scholars would understand, to reveal for all time just what was going on, but yet hide from the secular masses exactly what the truth of the matter was. So therefore it's very difficult to learn because it's encrypted from the get-go already in the first pasuk. It's Ahasuerus, the same Ahasuerus, you know what I mean? Now we're not going to tell you what that means, it's for you to delve. The whole Megillah's like this. Therefore the Megillah is recounting the whole episode about Vashti, the same Ahasuerus that killed his wife, so that everyone can understand Ahasuerus' fury and just how far it goes. When he became angry at his wife, he killed her at a mere suggestion of his good friend. And all this happened so that we would appreciate the wonder of the Megillah occurrence, that when Ahasuerus killed his beloved friend because of his wife, it's like a complete turnabout from what happened at the beginning of the story. The very man that told him to kill his wife will tell him to kill him. It's like a total head over tail. It's interesting that there's a Pirkei Derebi Eliezer. Pirkei Derebi Eliezer, chapter 11. And it explains that Ahasuerus was originally the balabos over the whole world, which was 240 provinces. He literally ran Earth. He was the king of Earth. If you were an alien coming to Earth, you would just land at Ahasuerus's palace and speak to him. Because once you speak to him, you've spoken to the leader of the humans. That's like going to another planet and meeting the Martians or something, and you want to speak to their leader. in the hope that you would be speaking to the leader of all the Martians to get that out of the way. You wouldn't go there and think there's like 500 states all with bickering argument. Who would you like? You know, you go to Europe. Who is Europe? If they're in, they're out there. They don't like it. They are part of the EC there. Who's leading the world? There's no one world leader. There's no one man or woman which commands humanity. In the days of Ahasuerus, Ahasuerus was the man. All 240 provinces were slicing up the entire earth. And he lost. When he destroyed the temple service, he abolished the service in the temple. He lost control over 113 provinces, leaving a remainder of 127 provinces. Now we can explain some of the issues about the beginning of the Megillah in the first four Pesukim. The Megillah is testifying to the greatness of the miracle which God did for us. This was done so that no one would say the one who wanted to do evil to us was Haman, who wished to destroy us. It was all him, and Ahasuerus was really nice and cuddly. And you should even give praise to King Ahasuerus, who killed Haman. That Haman did not specify at the outset against which people he wished to carry out the decree. Indeed, as we'll see in chapter 3, verse 8, he just said to Ahasuerus, there is a people, without spelling out the Jews. However, if he had disclosed immediately which people he was referring to, he was scared King Ahasuerus might not have conceded to that. And therefore, King Ahasuerus is such a nice guy because he would never have allowed the Jews to go. That's what you might think, right? That's why the Torah says, Vayhi b'mei Ahasuerus. It was in the days of Ahasuerus, not Haman. The real problem here was Ahasuerus. It was in his day that we were in woe. It didn't say in the days of Haman or Memuchan, Oyveizmir. It says, Vayhi b'mei, Oyvei Ahasuerus. He was the one that was the real problem here. So much so, there's a famous Gemara in Megillah 14a. And it says, Rabbi Abba gave a moshel. And he said, Ahasuerus and Haman, how could you compare them? To two people, one who had a mound of earth in his field that he didn't know what to do with, and the other who had a pit in his field. The pit owner said, who can give me a mound for money for which I can fill up this gap in my farm? And the mound owner said, who could give me money to get rid? I'll give money to anyone who brings a truck and takes away all this spare earth that's causing me an eyesore in my property. A few days later, the two men befriended one another, and the pit owner said to the mound owner, sell me your mound. And the mound owner said, if only you'll take it from me free of charge. It's a problem. The Maharsha says that the mound owner was Ahasuerus, who wished to rid himself of this annoying mound in the form of Klal Yisrael. And that Haman is the owner of the pit into which he wants to cast the mound, Klal Yisrael, because he needs to fill up that void. And Haman was willing to pay 10,000 pieces of silver to purchase the mound. But in chapter 3, verse 11, Ahasuerus says to him, the silver is given to you and also the people to do with as you see fit. And Rashi says there that we learn that Ahasuerus was just as willing and complicit in the final solution of the Jewish people as was Haman. I think if you want to bring it up to date, who was worse, Hitler or Himmler? Seems to me that Hitler had a mound in the form of a Jewish problem. And Himmler had the pit in which to cast them. Who was worse? They were as bad as each other. You might turn round, says the Medrash, and say, well, I bet Ahasuerus was really humbled by losing 113 countries from his kingdom, down to a paltry 127. Puh, what's that? That's chump change. That's chips for a ruler like him. Not at all. It says he was the same Ahasuerus. It was Vayihilameh Ahasuerus in the days of Ahasuerus, who owned all 240 provinces. His giver and his prideful conceit and his plans were identical after losing almost half of his kingdom. He didn't change in his mind outset at all. It's the same Ahasuerus, 113 countries drier. So don't think, now that he's lost 113, he's become all humble and he'll listen to Hashem and he'll be kind to the Jews and it's that naughty Haman who misled him. No, it's the same Ahasuerus who had the whole world at his feet and was only too happy to wipe out the Jews. He just needed someone to help him. But we can't say that outright in the text because he's going to read it. So we have to be very careful how we present this material. We don't say Hallel because we were still trapped in Persia. It was not a full redemption. So this thing was published while we were still in occupied Nazi Germany. So the Nazis, even though, you know, Hitler is dead, or Himmler is dead, killed by, Hitler, as it were, Hitler's still going to read this. And we've got to be careful, otherwise he'll find another Himmler. That's the situation here. It's very delicate. That's why scripture in the beginning of the Megillah did not specify a time period, such as in the 30th year of his reign, like we see in Nach. It was in the reign of King Jehoiakim or something like that, 3 years or something like that, and we've got the date of his reign, so we can chronologically, just said in the days, very, very laissez-faire date, somewhere in the reign of this blood, somewhere in Nazi-occupied Europe, when? 1935? 1945? Big difference, no? Somewhere in there. It just said, in those days. Had it become verse 2 with the words, in the something year of Ahasuerus's reign, we would not know whether the events at this time took place before or after the loss of the 113 provinces. So the verse says, in those days, to tell us that the banquet, which we're about to learn about, was in the days when Ahasuerus did not possess such great dominion as he did originally. He's now down to 127 provinces. That then relates to in year 3 of his reign. Is it really possible that Ahasuerus was not intelligent enough to grasp that he had lost almost half of the world? To brazenly celebrate at this time? He's lost half his kingdom. He's throwing a party for all the officials. Is he crazy? He shouldn't be doing that now. He should be mourning. The verse says that his festivities were held when the king Ahasuerus was sitting on the throne of his kingdom. That teaches us, says Chazal, that Ahasuerus felt assured that he would survive and there would be no more rebellions against him. Now that he's lost that 113, he won't lose one more. He is going to turn his fist so tight over those 127, no one will dare rebel against him in the future. He's going to knuckle down on these rulers and terrify them to stop any further rebellion. What made Ahasuerus so certain that the rulers of his remaining 127 provinces would not rebel against him? The Megillah says, "And the ministers of the provinces were before him, for the army of Persia and Media, and the ministers of the provinces." These were the rulers of the 127 provinces, were in front of him in Shushan. Each man arriving from his region in order to submit to the king's discipline, be subservient to him, and pay him tribute. This is a crafty way of doing political business. You might think that it was not wise of Ahasuerus to make this feast. But the Medrash Esther Rabbah 3:10 says that Vashti invited the ministers' wives to the feast. So if the ministers rebelled against their husbands, the wives could be held hostage. You want to say anything against my husband, the king? I'll lock up all your wives. So they were there as collateral. And Vashti was heading that prong of the political argument. The men and the women had to turn up, and the women were set aside that if one word was said, they'd lock up the wife. And Vashti was in charge of the women's side of the mechitza, if you know what I mean, and the suda. And she's like, yeah, you just make sure your husband doesn't say a word. So the women themselves were scared. They'd be telling their husbands, don't say anything against Ahasuerus or he'll kill me. That keeps some law and order, doesn't it? This is all part of Ahasuerus' plan. And Vashti, of course, felt so secure in her relationship with Ahasuerus that she was willing to be a willing partner in doing this for Ahasuerus. She never thought she was going to be stripped and paraded as a toy in front of the men and then doesn't agree and then gets killed. She clearly thought her position with Ahasuerus was solid. She's the empress of the world. So she's doing this for her own interests. That came to a very abrupt end. That's why it says, when he showed, rather he showed them, saying that he made a feast when he showed off his wealth to terrify all the ministers from the 127 provinces, that if you're going to rebel against me, I can pay all the money in the world to buy all the spies and assassins to kill you. However much you are paying an assassin to kill me, I'll quadruple the fee and have him kill you. I've just got too much money and too much power for you to anger me. I'll kill you first. He's terrifying these men. That's all he's bringing them there for, is to terrify them with his power. In the Medrash Rabbah, Esther Medrash Rabbah 1:15 and the Targum, they both say that Ahasuerus recalled which befell him after he abolished the service of the Holy Temple, which was 113 provinces being taken away from him. And instead of ruling over 240, he's down to 127. Now, you may have thought that he might have had feelings of tshuva, like Pharaoh in Egypt that starts to quake in his boots when the plagues come in. Maybe I should think twice. You'd think maybe Ahasuerus might get the feeling that God is hitting him back for turning off the temple service. It was a direct response. Yet again, Ahasuerus revoked the letters which he had originally sent out at Haman's suggestion, and the Jews were not harmed. You might claim, therefore, that Ahasuerus's actions saved the Jews rather than a miracle. You might read the Megillah and think it's all political. But as we'll see, it's not the case. Our salvation came about because the king was prone to constantly changing his mind. 1 minute, he would speak of annihilating a nation or destroying an individual, while at the next moment, he'd immediately regret his statement and become merciful. We'll see that this is absolutely key. Ahasuerus must have carefully reviewed the decree and thought, I was wrong to decree death for the Jews, and immediately regret it. We'll see how this was very useful for us at the end. Notice that when he killed Vashti, he was very upset at listening to Memuchan's advice, immediately regretting it and wanting another wife. This is all explaining the first four psukim as to the same Ahasuerus who was futile and weak and unable and fickle, but he still had the same energy and hatred as he was when he was on top of the world. The entire introductory psukim that we've looked at lends credence to the nisim and the wonders which God performed for us in a hidden fashion in those days with people that were completely unpredictable and not helpful to the Jews at all. Even if he did love the Jews, it would only be for Tuesday. On Wednesday, he'd want to kill him again. On Thursday, he'd feel bad and want to save the Jews. And on Friday, he'd want to kill him again. So clearly it's got to be a miracle that we got saved at all. Don't ascribe the redemption to natural causes. You have to ascribe it to God's providential input. Now I've got to start talking about, is everyone okay up to this point? Any questions up until this point on what we've said? Okay, what I want to talk about now is the party he made for the ministers and the display of his wealth, which is a very clever tactic. In the first section of Megillas Esther, from it was in the days of Ahasuerus, which is 1:1, all the way till chapter 2:5, where it says there was a Jewish man and it introduces Mordechai. That whole section, before we talk about Mordechai, that whole section illustrates the forceful stance the king took against the Jews and all of his provinces in general. He was a real dangerous man. He was not humbled by the loss of 113 provinces. He was still so wealthy and so powerful that the ministers of the provinces dared not rebel against him, even though they knew he was weak. Being so rich, he saw no reason to revoke his decision to destroy Klal Yisrael, as he would hardly miss their taxes. They were a useless people to keep alive. This tells us again the severity of Klal Yisrael's sin that we discussed last week, which was part to do with bowing down to Nebuchadnezzar's idol and partly to do with attending the feast and drinking the wine. It also shows us the intensity of Ahasuerus's anger, despite the fact we know he loved Vashti. It definitely is true he loved Vashti. In a fit of rage, he executed her. This man was highly unstable. In light of all these forces, the miracle becomes evident. And therefore, it's a mitzvah to read the entire letter of Megillah, even starting from 1:1, not just 2:5. You might have an argument saying, we don't need all these introductory verses. Just skip to 2:5 where we get to the meat and potatoes, where we start to talk about Mordechai. Answer is, you need to know the backdrop to realize how this thing was a real miracle. If you don't know what's potting here, you don't know what's going on. Mordechai coming on the scene won't help you. In 1:4, we saw that when he showed the wealth of his kingdom's honor, that's what the Pasuk says. What's that got to do with the ministers and providence being before him? If you exhibit your wealth to the populace of the land, that is not comparable to displaying it in front of affluent people. You can show your riches and treasures to paupers day after day, and they'll discover something they've never seen before every day. But if you show off your riches to the super wealthy, the upper classes, the aristocracy, for 10, 20 days at most, then they start to yawn. Oh, well, I've got a super yacht, and I've got a few helicopters, and I've got a few, you know. How could you keep going for 180 days and dazzle them with your wealth? You have to understand the enormous wealth which Ahasuerus had amassed. Even though the ministers of the providence were before him and these people were prime ministers and kings of their own lands, he still prolonged his showing of the wealth for so many days, 180 days non-stop, where they were blown away by wealth, more wealth each day than before. This is such a big topic that the Gro discusses this in Esther Rubber 2:1. 2:1. And he says as follows. Ahasuerus, says the Gro, did not earn all this wealth by himself. He didn't go to work and invent some kind of thing and got money for it. The Medrash states that Nebuchadnezzar amassed vast treasures that were recovered by Cyrus and then inherited by Ahasuerus. It says in the Targum that Nebuchadnezzar's treasures filled 1,080 ships. The entire ship full of treasure. 1,080 of them. Ahasuerus wanted to show off every one of these treasure chests, but he considered it unbecoming to gather the people to display his wealth. So he made a big feast, and every day when the where everyone was reveling in the festivities, he would invite them to view several treasures. By drawing out the festivities for 180 days, and showing off six treasures per day, he displayed all 1,080 of Nebuchadnezzar's treasure ships to everybody. But there's a Ma'am Loez which says it different, against the Gro, it seems. He says it's not Nebuchadnezzar's money, it's the Jews' money. Does any, you know, I took a March of the Living with a JLE group to Poland. And when we got there, we saw one of the famous cattle trucks, which has been preserved in a museum. And the locomotive, the choo-choo train bit at the front, had armor plating on. And I asked a very knowledgeable man why it is that it was armor plated, and he didn't know. Have you got any idea why the trains that took the Jews to Auschwitz were bulletproof?
They were worried that the locals would shoot the carriages and would actually shoot the engine driver at the same time.
Alavai, that would have only been true. But the stories are, when a Jew was in the cattle truck looking out at the farmers, as they drove by, all the farmers were doing this. They weren't going to shoot anyone. They're only too happy the Nazis do their job. Why were the locomotives armoured? Here's the reason I found out years later. Those trains were guided by a computer system that was run by IBM, a willing, complicit partner to the genocide of Jews by Hitler. He paid IBM to organise the train system, and every Jew was given a tattoo, which was a number of the IBM punch card that was allotted to every Jew in the American computer system. And the Americans helped the Nazis kill the Jews, because without IBM, they couldn't have done it. Why were they so keen to give punch cards to people they were only going to slaughter? Answer is, and think about this deeply, Rabosai, those trains were two-way machines. They ferried Jews to their deaths and ferried their money to Switzerland. And the complicated system is managing a Europe-wide logistical system of Jews to the camps, trains to Switzerland. Turn the trains around, get them to the Jews, take the Jews to the camp, rob them of all their wealth and get the money back to Switzerland. They were armoured because they were Securicor trains delivering money to the bank. They took the gold and the money and the treasures and banked it in Switzerland. How true is that? Well, listen to the Maayam Loez who writes on the Megillah. How does he calculate it? On the Maayam Loez, or in section 1046, Maayam Loez number 1046, he says that the treasure houses that he showed off contained all the gold and the silver that was from the temple treasury. As it says in Ezra 1:11, that the number of vessels Nebuchadnezzar looted from the temple and that Ahasuerus acquired was 5,400 vessels. The Gemara in Shabbos 126b says that the term Otzer, a storehouse, refers to a place that contains no less than five vessels each. So if Ahasuerus invited his guests into six storehouses of treasure each day, and he showed them 30 vessels per day, by going on for 180 days, he showed off all the 5,400 vessels of treasure that was taken from the temple treasury of the first temple. It was Jewish money. That's how the Nazis became rich. And Switzerland won't give it back because all the accounts are closed. Amazing how history plays a game. Isn't it true in the Arc de Triomphe, or the arch that they've put up in Italy, that they've got a picture of the Jews, all their treasures being carried off to the Vatican? They actually engraved it. The Romans took the menorah and everything off.
It's the Arch of Titus.
Arch of Titus, thank you. Jewish money has made quite a few Gentile kingdoms. The cathedral in Lincoln, which was the largest building in the world at the time, all built by Jewish financiers who were forced to give over their money to build Lincoln Cathedral.
Rabbi, Michael Krebs here.
Yeah.
Rabbi, why was there so much money in the temple?
Remember, the temple treasury had to be donated to by every Jew, and it was donated to year in, year out for 410 years. On top of that, all Gentile kings found it their privilege to donate lavish gifts and amount to the temple for their own purposes of gaining praise. The place was a heap of man. It says in Solomon's day, when he made the temple, he was able to amass so much money, it was more than all the predecessors of the kings put together. And he was only the first king during the temple era. The place was full and full. You know, so much, you know, in the Mishnah of Terumah and Me'ilah, you've got this thing, if an individual wanted to dedicate a forest or his house or his value or his daughter to the temple, you would take a valuation of gold or money of whatever it is you wanted to dedicate and give that as a gift to the temple treasury. That was so common, we have an entire tractate of Mishnah written about it. People would want to say thank you to God. They'll say, I'll dedicate my value to the temple. They'd go to the Kohen. The Kohen would make a monetary valuation of the person. Say, right, pay £10,000 to the temple. It's like you gave your life to God, as it were. He'd pay £10,000, put it in the temple treasury and walk off. And that'd be like a korban. If you stole the money, it's subject to Me'ilah because it's now temple treasury. Amazing, no? You should know that the concept of security was, heaven forbid, you'd walk out with a coin, you'd be subject to the punishment of Me'ilah, you'd need to give a korban if you did it accidentally. If you didn't do it accidentally, the punishment is death at the hands of heaven. When you're walking in a place with 10 open miracles a day, and the Kohanim walking barefoot amongst the flames, you don't need security guards. You can't take modern secular ideas of security and plant it upon Solomon's temple. It's a good question, though. Thank you for asking it. So that's how he was able to show off such a ridiculously vast wealth that even kings and leaders of other countries would be bound to watch for 180 days while every day they see more and more and more and more wealth until they're frankly sick of it. They realise this guy is so wealthy, he's so resourceful, you might as well just join him. You can't fight him. We're not there yet. We're not there. No, that was at the... We're not there. This was at the banquet where he was showing off his wealth. Not at the party where he had the Jews attend. This is the banquet of wealth. He did that first. At the end of that, then we've got the feast for the Jews. Notice how, please, the tremendous, it makes me want to spit. He made a party to destroy the Jews with what money? With Jewish money he ransacked from the temple. Adolf Hitler, Yamach Shemoy, financed the machine of the Holocaust with the gold teeth he pulled out of his Jewish victims. Carbon copy. Carbon copy. The Jews are going to get killed and they're going to pay for it. Take the Jewish money and use it to kill them. Even happened in Egypt. We'll get the Jews to be the financiers of their own destruction. They did it then, they've done it again. It's like reading a carbon copy of the Megillah.
The same happened in Spain, Rabbi, 500
years ago. That's right, that's right. They took all the Jews' wealth. And I'd like to point out, I heard Stephen Elias explain to me when he was for his mother's yard site, the same happened in Iran when they expelled the Jews. They got the Jews to pay for the flights. They kicked the Jews out using the Jewish money. They took the Jewish money and paid for the planes. They didn't have the decency to pay for the planes to get rid of them themselves. They'll say the Jews can pay. It's the Jews. Unbelievable. Unbelievable audaciousness. Don't think Hashem didn't take note of that. No wonder he said to Moshe Rabbeinu, I'm asking you a favor. Get all the ladies and all the men to ask for trinkets from the Egyptians. All the money they stole from you to kill you, you'll get everything back. You will leave with unimaginable wealth. You'll drain the wealth of Egypt. Do me this favor. Ask everyone to ask for, on the plague of darkness, go around the Egyptian houses and look for where they leave their trinkets. Then ask, could I borrow a trinket? And they say, I don't have it. Yeah, that's interesting. In your jewelry box in the second drawer, you got a nice bracelet. And the Egyptians are like, oh, that one. Yeah, that one. They go, oh, you can have it. Oh, thank you. It's just repatriation money. I heard in the beginning of the State of Israel, Mercedes-Benz gave the early State of Israel a good deal on taxi cars, which is why all the taxis in Israel are Mercedes, because they felt bad for building the ovens. I guess that's a good deal, isn't it? Ridiculous. Notice.
All the shrooms at the beginning, in the early days, were always Mercedes. And you're right, it was the way Germany gave money back.
They felt bad.
Yeah,
the ovens were marked with a stamp saying Daimler Benz. Unbelievable. Don't worry, we'll give you cheap taxis. Let bygones be bygones, hey? Ahasuerus did not display his wealth gradually. Had he have done so, then in day one, nobody would see how rich he really was. It says when he showed his wealth, it was for many days, namely 180 days. That must be, you don't sum up the period of 180 days as 6 months. You express it in terms of individual days. That on every single day, Ahasuerus showed his guests an article which was proportionate to the wealth of his kingdom's honour and the splendour of his glorious greatness, as it says in the Pasuk. This is why it says when he showed, continuous tense, and then he showed in past tense, that's a verb. And that indicates that he was showing these treasures for many, many days back to back. 180 days. And that was to indicate that it was the fact that when he showed his wealth, only afterwards did he then decide to provide a meal for the Jews. First things first, establish his authority by an overt, explicit display of unimaginable wealth. Then get on with the business of destroying the Jews. Once I'm secure and nobody will rebel against me any further, I can get on with business. We're going to finish this bit now. This is the end of all the first four verses. That'll take us through to verse 5. There's a continuity between verses 2 through 4. Look at this. There were two feasts that took place. And that's the idea in the Gemara Megillah, Yud Beis Omad Aleph, 12b, that Rav and Shmuel were disputing whether Ahasuerus was clever or stupid for first making a banquet for those distant from him and then making a banquet for those close to him. But both Rav and Shmuel agree that there were two separate feasts. That's why it says, in those days, when the king Ahasuerus was sitting, literally on the throne of his kingdom in Shushan, which was inside the palace, the king actually sat on his royal throne to inspire awe in his subjects, and he made a feast for all of his ministers and servants and the ministers of the provinces while he sat on the throne and they ate and looked at his money. They saw him up on a stepped throne. He copied the throne of Solomon, which had steps. He wanted to be like King Solomon. So he was sitting at the top of this like golden tower, looking down on everyone eating and them looking at his wealth. And he made this feast inside the palace rather than in the garden courtyard of the palace, which we'll learn about later, which is all about where the Jews were. That was what the second feast was about. But there was room in the garden for more people to be sat comfortably than there was in the palace. So wasn't he stupid? He could have had more people outdoor than indoor. That's why it says, the first feast was held when he showed the wealth of his kingdom's honour. That's the pasuk. It's only proper to have displayed such wealth in the privacy of a palace rather than in his garden. When you go to see the crown jewels, it's inside the Tower of London, not at a fair stall in the street. To flaunt the king's wealth in the presence of all the people of Shushan, from young and old, was inappropriate. That's why the Megillah says that the feast was held for 180 days, because it wasn't fitting for the king to invite all the general populace of Shushan to a feast for so many days, but only the distinguished ministers. So the first feast for 180 days was for crowned heads only. Are you the head of Ethiopia? Yes, you're welcome in. Have a look at this. Are you some Nachanebish from the back of, I don't know, Withenshaw? Yeah, you'll wait to the second feast. It's not for you to come in and see the throne room and all the money. I'm here to inspire awe among the gentry and the aristocracy to terrify them in submission. You, I've already got in submission. I don't need to do this. That's why verse 5, we're starting a new pasuk at the last few minutes. And when these days were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days. This is not the 180-day feast. This is another feast for all the people who were present in Shushan, the capital. This is now for the general populace, not just invited leaders, from great to small, in the garden courtyard of the royal palace. And this is where the Medrash Rabbah on Esther Zayin Yud Gimel 7:13 says that who designed the second feast? Who was the interior designer for feast number 2? Haman. Haman worked closely with Achashverosh to organize the interior architecture and design, which is why the next few verses seem to uselessly describe the minutiae of the details of the interior look of this party. Every single element was there for a purpose, and it was placed there by our arch enemy, who had his own designs on us even before Achashverosh. Haman and Achashverosh invited the Jews to the royal table and offered them food and drink in the form of bread and wine for a banquet. And he paraded harlots in front of the Jews to seduce them, to cause them to sin. It was specifically designed to be a place and an environment to rip Klal Yisrael away from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. As we learn out, Amalek aren't so much against the Jews. They're merely using the Jews as a lever to spite God. Their real war isn't with the Jew. Their real war is with the God of the Jew. But they know to hurt him, you hurt his children. Those evil ones knew that God hates immorality. And our Rabbonim, our Chazal, have said that all the people who were present in verse 5 refers to the Yidden, the Jewish people. Because of their participation in the feast, they deserved annihilation, Rachmanas Lanolenu, that was harking back to the sin of bowing down to Nebuchadnezzar's idol. In fact, the Medrash teaches that Haman personally assembled 18,500 Jews for the banquet. People, how was he able to get 18,500 Jews there? There's a whole Medrash here. How did he get so many Jews to the banquet? How could he force you to go? If the Goyish government now said they're going to have a banquet with harlots and tray for food, would you go? How was it able for him to assemble you there? Look at the Nazis. First things first, you take a census of the Jewish population prior with names and addresses of everyone. Then you force everyone on the list to turn up under fear of punishment. This went back years, Rabbi Sai. He organized a census to make sure there were no Jews missing from the city. How did he know there were no Jews missing? Because he had a register. How did he have a register? He organized a census with this in mind. When the Germans took occupation of the new countries in Europe, what was the first thing they did? They set up tables and got Jews to turn up and give their names and addresses on a register. Little did the Jews know that that register was then sent to America and processed by IBM to turn them into numbers for processing. IBM, by the way, don't dispute any of this. They just don't discuss it. This wicked Haman is a case where he applied the concept of getting the Jews together to make sure they'd be there. And he was working with Ahasuerus at the end of the feast for all the ministers to make a special feast for Klal Yisrael to get them to be weakened in their relationship with Hashem, to make them pliable for destruction. Notice, when Moses turned up to Pharaoh and demanded the Jews become religious by keeping a three-day festival outside of Egypt, he wanted to break their spirits. The Torah goes on record to say the work was designed to crush their spirit, not for any practical purpose. I have to bleach out the idea of religiosity from the Jews to make them mine. You can't lose 600,000 slaves. So he says, you're lazy. Get to work. Now that work was useless. They could make the bricks. The point was, don't think, Pharaoh said, don't think about such religious ideas. Your crazy things got into your head, such as God and devotion and religion. It's all members of part. You work for me now. Same things going on. When the days of the first feast were completed and Ahasuerus had shown off his wealth for 180 days, why would he wish to make a second feast for seemingly no apparent purpose? You finished 180 days, call it quits, pack up and go home. The decision was only the result of Haman's counsel. Regarding the first feast, the verse simply says he made a feast. Whereas regarding the second one, it says the king made a feast. That indicates that the same king, Ahasuerus, the one who seems like such a good guy, stood steadfast in his rebellion against God, having stopped the avoider in the temple, being punished with the loss of 113 provinces, and now wishes to cap it all by killing all the Jews, irrelevant to the fact that God's already shown him displeasure when he stopped the temple avoider. But Ezra Shem, next week, we will start verse 6.